This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvaraj
and Majida Hashim.
A whole bunch of stories lined up for you today. We have a story about how you could unlock your phone using something else other than your thumbs and your face.
Mm-hmm.
A story about a biodegradable car. That's an interesting one. Mercury-safe tuna. We're going to be speaking about transhumanism a little bit, mm-hmm. H+, as I know that the shortcut is, and a South Korean city that's moving forward of having an idea with no cars at all.
Yeah.
No cars in their plans.
It should be an interesting story. Okay, if you want to get in touch with our show this afternoon, you get us on Twitter. We are at BFM Radio, of course. You can get us on WhatsApp, 018-789-8899. Right. We've all unlocked your phone using a passcode, mm-hmm. some of us using a fingerprint,
mm.
some of us even using our faces, right?
Mm-hmm.
How about if you were to be able to do it using your sweat?
I mean, like drip sweat onto the phone and
possibly,
then it unlocks.
Possibly, yeah. So there's this guy called Jan Halamek. He's a chemist at the State University of New York, and he's using this case for securing phones and other devices with our sweat. In a recent article he's published in Chem. The idea isn't new. People have been talking about it for at least a decade. But his research group has taken a hard look at how our devices could analyze the chemicals in sweat to protect our security. Now, every method meant to ensure you're the only person who can access your phone has its problems, as we know. A passcode can be stolen or guessed. Plus, it can be annoying to type it in every single time. Fingerprint readers can be finicky, and I know that for a fact. Mm. I have one of those iPhone, you know, with the fingerprint readers. It only works about 45% of the time. Particularly if your hands are sweaty, it will not read. And, you know, stuff, you can spoof fingerprints and all that kind of stuff. And this whole idea of Apple's new Face ID technology, we know, has already been hacked.
Yeah.
Right? So all of these things are a little bit worrying. Stuff like you were talking about a couple of weeks ago, Arvin, the whole idea of, you know, voice ID and one thing like that.
Mm-hmm.
We know, again, that there is now software appearing on the market that can mimic and mock our own voices. So that's a little bit worrying. It's not entirely practical. So this guy has come forward with the idea of using sweat and other bodily fluids. What he means by that, I don't know, but I don't want to explore. But the idea is, you know, everything that we eat and where we live and the genetics, they determine our metabolism, and they therefore are an absolute unique identifier. Even though fingerprints are, fingerprints can be spoofed. You know, your sweat cannot be spoofed. That could be used. So if you could have a reader on your phone that could, you know, literally lick up the sweat on your thumb and unlock your phone, at least that way we know it's fairly accurate, right?
Yeah, but it's such a disgusting idea. It's like putting sweat. I mean, your phones, someone did a study, I think, a couple of years ago where they said that your phones are one of the dirtiest things in your pocket or in your whole house.
Yeah.
If you don't wash your hands before touching your food, it's fine. But if you touch your phone, make sure you wash your hands before touching your food because it's full of grime and sweat and stuff. So it's not like your phones are clean already, so using your sweat can be okay. But it's just, how sure are you that we're always sweating? Like, on how sweaty do your palms have to be, or how sweaty do you have to be to unlock your phone? We sit in this aircon office, it's cold most of the time. Unless you go downstairs to get food or something, you never sweat, like, at all. So it's
that,
kind
that's
of
where the other bodily fluids part comes in.
Yeah. Maybe you could lick it to
the
unlock
phone,
it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's because it's so much better. No, I mean, like, you know, it sounds like, you know, those contracts you see in the movies where they're making a deal with the devil.
So you sign with blood.
With a drop of blood.
Yeah.
That could be. I don't know if he's going to move to blood in the future. If you just, like, how they get your sugar reading and stuff, like a small prick by the phone, and then it unlocks it for you.
Yeah, that would be nice, would it?
Yeah.
I mean, these people who are checking their WhatsApp every 2 minutes, they'd be getting
pricks all the time.
Yeah. Not for that.
But it's cooler than sweat.
Right?
Yeah, it's not as as gross.
Sweat's a no-no then. We say no to sweat.
That's okay.
All right, Majida, what do you think?
It is not just one time that you'll be dripping sweat onto this thing. It's every time you want to unlock your phone.
Yeah.
So if you are checking your phone, say, 20 times an hour, you'll be licking or dripping sweat on your phone.
Yeah.
20 times an hour, God knows how many times that goes to a day. But, you know, like, fluid and phone doesn't really go together that well. They're not supposed to, but and this thing is going to have this thing that captures fluid.
The fluid and the salts and the dirt or whatever your food has transferred into to come out as sweat is going to be used.
That's what's going to be on your phone.
On your phone, your phone reader and stuff. I don't know. You said about the fingerprint reader. I don't want to jinx it, so tap on wood. But mine works 99.9% of the time.
Does
yeah,
it?
I just use either one of my index fingers. The fingerprint reader's at the back, and it's like a slight tap, and then it's on in about less than a second.
This is the thing with the Apple ones. When the new iOS came out, iOS 11, and I was actually speaking to David Chu about this, when it first dropped, my fingerprint reader had never been more accurate, you know? Mm-hmm. Boom, it just unlocked it immediately. I'm like, finally, they fixed it.
Yeah.
And then they've upgraded it to 11.1 or whatever, and now it's exactly the same as it was before. But I've noticed that if I clean it and I wipe off the smudges, it tends to be okay, but it's just not accurate at all.
Okay, because I'm just thinking there must be another way to do it other than sweat. I don't know if I saw a phone that said it could unlock
lick
it based on my
here.
Sweat. Yeah, no, I wouldn't. I'd be like, no, I'm not buying this because even
the demonstrations in the phone stores would be entirely different. This is how you unlock it, and you know you're watching these you know salespeople licking the phone. You're like, yeah, I don't think I want that.
Yeah,
part of the phone would you put that in the first place? Would you put that where that button is, or would you put it back? Or?
Majida, your guess is as good as mine. Your guess. As good as mine.
No, I'm going to stick with fingerprints because if someone is going to take the trouble to spoof my fingerprint, then they deserve to unlock my phone. Because if you go through all that trouble, I don't know how you're going to get a mark of my fingerprint and then you unlock it. Plus, there's junk in the phone.
That's
like,
true.
It's memes, it's GIFs, it's photos of places that other person has never been to. So if you want that, then...
It's the poor, unfortunate person who hacked into your phone.
Yeah. You know, speaking about phones, we tried out the pop socket.
Yes.
Last week. So we've been using it over the weekend. So quick reviews.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Mine is still on. I've used it quite a lot. It has become, I wouldn't say invaluable, but I have definitely seen an improvement in my phone behavior in terms of my wrist is no longer aching when I'm like, you know what I mean? I can now hold it at a distance and one thing or another, I can pop
it's
my
not
phone.
It's not at a weird angle all the time, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's not at a weird angle. And I feel more confident walking around typing one-handed now. I know yours disappeared after 24 hours or so.
Yeah, I use it
You just needed to persevere, Arvin.
I know, because for me, the phone needs to lock into that arm that I use in my car. So that's the most important use of my phone. It's where I use my phone the most because I'm listening to podcasts or whatever I can on the way to work and I have a long commute.
Yeah.
So if it can't do that, then it completely defeats the purpose of having a phone, basically.
But didn't you get the socket for it as well?
I did. But then it has to go in the aircon vents.
Right.
I don't want to block the aircon vent. And it's way more convenient because I have a tiny Bluetooth reader.
Yeah.
And then I just hook up the phone to the arm on the windscreen. And then it just plays whatever I want, like podcasts. And then I use it to Waze because I need to know which Waze. Like it has traffic and doesn't have traffic.
Yeah.
So that's the most important use for my phone. And if I can't do that, if something's blocking that, then it's
no
like
good.
A definite no. Mm.
Majida, I noticed you've blinged yours up a little bit.
I had to customize it lah because we got some with cartoon figures and things
you
like that, and I wanted to bond with my pop socket.
Oh, I see.
What I found is that I didn't really use it utility wise because it to me to extend it and to pop it all the way, it's just really bulky and inconvenient. So not really for what it's meant to be. But I found myself using it as like a fidget device,
when
you get nervous, you're playing with it, it pops up and down. Mm-hmm. So I'm playing with it as anxiety management, as a fidget device. So
it works that way?
It works that way for me. That's how
Is that a thumbs up or a thumbs down then?
I don't know for how long I would play with it. I think I'm going to spoil it pretty soon because I'm just playing it all the time. So as long as you're still there, it's the flavor of the day.
Okay. Oh, I mean, thumbs up, thumbs down.
Thumbs down, for
thumbs
sure.
Down.
Thumbs down.
You're thumbs up.
I'm a thumbs up, and you're on the fence then, right?
I'm
now.
On the fence.
This went
non-committal.
Nowhere.
We ain't got nowhere. Anyway, folks, do let us know what you think. You know, would you unlock your phone with sweat? Let us know a little bit about that. We need to move on to story number two. We have a story about a biodegradable car that's made entirely from sugar beet.
Yeah. So
interesting stuff.
Environmentally friendly motoring is usually associated with either electric or hybrid vehicles or improved fuel efficiency. But now a group of students is challenging the idea beyond just using fuels, but the actual substance that the car is made out itself. Over the past few years, the cars have gone, they've experimented with aluminium and carbon fiber, things to make it lighter as a light alternative to steel. But the problem with using carbon fiber and aluminium and things like that is that the material itself requires 5 times more energy to make.
Right.
So although you save energy by at the driving stage, you're actually increasing the energy at the production phase, which goes around anyway. So what they have done is created Lina, which is the first ever car to be built from natural fibers, flax and sugar beets, to be precise. They are students from Eindhoven University Technology in the Netherlands. The chassis, body and the interior of the car is made from resin derived from flax, a plant that can be grown in any moderate climate, and combined with bioplastic made entirely from sugar beets.
Brilliant.
So the resulting material has a strength to weight ratio which is similar to fiberglass. Only the wheels and the suspension system is not made out of bio-based materials for now. The whole car weighs 310 kilos, making it makes the electric engine more efficient because it's a lighter car. It's powered by modular battery packs, and Lina can reach a top speed of 80 kilometers per hour.
Is it safe?
It is already roadworthy. It is certified roadworthy by the Netherlands Vehicle Authority, but it just needs to go through the crash test to see whether it will withstand pressure. Mm. But it is already roadworthy. You can actually drive it on the road already.
Can we eat it?
I think you can.
Technically,
I don't see a problem.
Apart from the wheels and the chassis, right?
Yeah, I don't see a problem with you eating the car.
Right. That you know that's going to be a challenge we're going to be seeing on TV
from the
Netherlands.
Yeah.
You know? Who can eat Speed Eater Lina?
Speed
Eater Lina is going to be the new TV.
So it's a car made of sugar beets, basically.
And
like
flex.
Most of the cars made by sugar beets.
Most of the cars, everything except the suspension and the wheel.
I mean, as proof of concept, obviously it works.
But it works.
Do we see mass manufacture of this? Really?
I don't know. There is no mention in this article about how much it costs to make this and whether or not mass production is actually an option. The fastest you can go is 80 kilometers per hour, lah. So it might
be
around
just
the
a city
utility car. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very zippy. It's a very small. I think it looks like a 2-seater car, but it's not the first biodegradable car attempt. In Japan, scientists are looking into wood pulp to make a wooden car. Ford has announced a project to include bamboo into parts of his car. So it is in that direction. It may not be as glamorous as, flying cars, autonomous cars, or electric cars and things like that. But there are steps in trying to make this car more environmentally friendly in that form.
And we like that.
Yeah.
All right. We've got to take a break, folks. We've got some music coming up. It is U2 with Desire. When we come back, a story about mercury-safe tuna. Mm-hmm. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Enterprise BizBytes. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes on BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. My name is Rich Bradbury. If you're only just joining us, I'm in the studio with
Majida Hashim,
Arvind Yuvaraj.
So we've had stories about how you could possibly unlock your phone with sweat or another bodily fluid, biodegradable car that we figured you can't eat. Maybe you can.
Maybe you can.
It runs at 80 kilometers an hour, roughly. And then we also talked about pop sockets because we started using them last week. We have a thumbs up, a thumbs down, and an on the fence.
And thumbs somewhere in the middle.
All right. Now we're going to talk about mercury-safe tuna, or a company that's really on a bit of a mission, right?
Yeah. So this is about Safe Catch. They're not a new company, but they're being highlighted more and more in the news nowadays. So I thought we can highlight them as well. It was founded by someone named Sean Wittenberg. So what happened was back when he was finishing up his studies, his mom got diagnosed with mercury poisoning because she got used to eating canned tuna like 2 or 3 times a week. And then she got mercury poisoning. She had she got lethargic, short-term memory loss, and some sort of muscle weakness as well. So all the signs of mercury poisoning. But then it's difficult to test for mercury poisoning because it takes a few weeks or maybe even a month and a half. And then each test costs about $30, I think. Yeah.
Is it really that much of a problem then?
Yeah, it is. The test itself.
Yeah. I mean mercury poisoning.
It is. I mean, it depends on the dosage.
Right.
Because I did some reading and then it said it depends on how the mercury is ingested or what kind of contact you have with the mercury and how much is ingested as well.
No, the reason I'm asking because I eat a heck of a lot of canned tuna.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've heard horror stories of some places where tuna is supplied, and then people say always avoid tuna from places where you don't know the source.
Right.
Because it has a tendency of, there's potential of mercury poisoning with tuna. So what he wanted to do was he wanted to have a device that could test for poisoning on the spot without having to wait and stuff. So he designed this machine where you could do something like a biopsy on a small piece of tuna. And then it would give you the results on the spot, because he didn't want someone else to go through the same thing that his mom went through. He didn't want the long diagnosis and stuff. And he said that mercury poisoning is a big problem. The thing is, when he went to the FDA, they didn't want to implement it because of, they said, bandwidth problems and stuff. And then when he went to the fishing companies, they liked the product, they liked the machine, but then they didn't want to use it because they said they were already abiding by the FDA's minimum standards. And they didn't want to have this thing show them that their stock might be dangerous.
Right.
Mm. You know, because if you, you know, ignorance is bliss. If you don't know something is wrong, then you just keep selling it. Right?
Yeah.
So he decided to make his own company, and that's when he founded Safe Catch. So Safe Catch says that it has like the lowest, if it says here, let me just pull up this thing. So Safe Catch says that it's a tuna company which has the lowest mercury of any brand of tuna on the market. Based on FDA standards, they say that a concentration of over one part per million is dangerous, and Safe Catch health standard of 0.1 is 10 times stricter than FDA standards.
Wow.
10 times. But it also sells for double the price because they said that it is safe tuna, and they make sure that they go through all these very like stringent processes and stuff to make sure that the fish is safe. So first what the team does is they inspect the fish to ensure that it meets the standards. Then it has to fall within the normal size for that particular type of tuna, and then it has to show no visible deformities or strange odors, or it shouldn't have any kind of disease. Then they make sure that the methods and labor practices of the fishing companies they source from, it falls within the line of ethical standards, and that that type of tuna is not endangered in any way. And it only sources from fisheries that have been certified by the U.S. Department of Commerce. Then, but the thing is, the weird part is they say that the fish that don't pass the test are given back to the fishermen, and they're probably sold to other tuna companies. Oh,
wow.
Yeah. The ones that pass the test are canned, and then they're shipped to North America, where it's sold in about 7,500 locations, which compared to conventional canned tuna, it retails for about double the price, a premium which health conscious, especially people who are parents and don't want to give these tuna to kids, they will be willing to pay Safe Catch for safe tuna.
You see, and that's where my issue lies. You know, we talk about how the food chain should be healthy, should be clean. We know it's not, right?
Yeah.
But the reason that I bought tuna is for the most part, it seems to be a healthy amount of protein. It's fairly cheap. It's easily accessible wherever you are in the world. It's something you can always go to and rely on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would I pay double for a tuna that I know doesn't have any mercury in it or very, very minimal? I don't think I would, you know.
No?
No.
Mm. Let's say like a can of tuna now goes for about $6. It used to be like four. Now it's about six, bordering on seven.
Yeah.
You wouldn't pay like 14, 15 bucks for a can of tuna?
I don't think I would, no.
No. Mm. Because tuna
That's almost a full, that's normally a meal or at least a meal and a bit, you know.
Yeah. Because I mean, when people go for tuna, it's so that the food is cheap. They want to buy a can and then they spread it across maybe a lunch and a dinner and another lunch with a few slices of bread or something.
Or if you're me, you have it on one sandwich.
Yeah. But it's still cheaper than getting a meal in KL.
Yeah, it is.
So
yeah.
I don't know how much people would be willing to pay for, you know, safe tuna or whatever. Because like you said, mercury poisoning isn't something that many people know about.
You don't think about it.
Yeah, I learned about it, I think last year, I think I read something where someone said the tuna is dangerous, blah, blah, blah. And it was connected to a very famous restaurant that uses a lot of tuna that we have here as well. But then it goes unnoticed. And I guess when it's not a big problem, they don't know that it is a problem at all when it comes to things like tuna and other canned foods and stuff. What Safe Catch wants to do is that they want to help the market by zeroing in on the fish that are contaminated, because they're going to use data, because everything's, you know, data now. When they do the tests and then they find out that a specific fish is contaminated, because they can do biopsies on each individual fish, they will then figure out where the fish came from, which school it came from, and which part of the ocean it came from. And then by studying that, they'll know why that specific location is contaminated, then how to reduce contamination in that part of the ocean area.
Yeah. See, that I like. Mm. That's a great idea. And I'm sure, I've no doubt that there would be people willing to pay for this.
Yeah.
Absolutely no doubt. Like you say, parents in particular.
Yeah. My contention with this is still the price, because this happens with a lot of things that want to be ethical, that wants to be more responsible and things like that. That responsible and ethically sourced things become a luxury that only people who can afford it.
Right.
So if you want to lead a clean life, you want to lead an ethical life, you want to be free from poisoning and things like that, you have to be able to pay for it. It becomes like good things become a luxury, and for everybody else, then you have to contend with the rejected fish that these guys don't want, so that you can afford it. So if you can afford, you can afford health. But if you cannot afford it, then you don't become healthy.
No, but I want to ask another question. If, like, I think we spoke about this before. If even locally, if you sell something that costs less, but you sell it for a cheaper price, people will ignore your product. Mm. And people will go towards the things that's more expensive because they just think it's healthier or it has more quality. Just say you have like an apple juice that is pure apple, and then you sell it for $3 here locally. And then you have another apple juice with the exact same apple, but then you brand it as something that's like $12, cold, dripped, whatever, something apples.
Yeah.
People will go buy the $12 apple.
And they are doing in droves.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is the same argument we're having with stuff like electric cars as well. We know it's better for us. We know it's better for the planet. Yet the prices, the premium prices we have to pay for a product we know is going to do us all good in the long run. Mm-hmm. It's the same argument, right? Mm-hmm. We all want healthier and better things, and yet we're having to pay through the nose for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And we kind of trust the stuff that's marketed for cheap less than the expensive goods. Yeah. For some reason, I don't know why.
That's just a consumer sentiment. The consumer sentiment that if it is more expensive, therefore it has to be better for us. That whereas there are things in the market which are very affordable and they are just as good. They may not have a giant carbon footprint, for example. It might not come from the US or from Australia or something, but that makes it expensive. But it's locally made, for example. It's just as good. But because it's priced less, people assume that it may not be as good as something that's more expensive.
And even if it's local, that's another thing. They think it's less quality than the stuff that comes from overseas and all. And also, I mean, Sean, the guy Sean Wittenberg, he wanted to market the machine to other people. He wanted to give it to a vendor, and he wanted the FDA to use the machine for all kinds of tuna. So I guess he came from a good place.
He
wanted the machine to be used for every kind of tuna and like for every fishery to use it before sending out the tuna to the market.
But they said no.
I mean, the guys in the fishing sector didn't want it because they didn't want to know that the tuna was bad. And the FDA said they didn't have the facilities or the bandwidth to implement something like this. So he just, you know, he went ahead and made money for himself.
He's done the right thing. He has done the right thing. Right, we have to take a break. Music coming up. It is Ted Leo and the Pharmacists with Me and Mia. We'll be back in just a few minutes here on BFM 89.9.
Bigotry Free Malaysia. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bites. My name is Rich Bradbury. I'm joined in the studio by
Arvind Yuvaraj
and Majidah Hashim.
One of the things that we talk about here quite a lot, we talk about flying cars, we talk about augmented reality and virtual reality. I kind of want to take a little bit of a step forward in time. This is an article I picked up from Forbes. And it's the article is called Transhumanism and the Future of Humanity, 7 Ways the World Would Change by 2030. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of one of those mystic kind of let's look at the future and see what might happen. But I was reading through some of it, and it's really interesting to look at what they've done. And Forbes Group have this Visionary Innovation Group, right? And they looked at 3 fundamental pillars of humanity and how they will evolve over the coming 10 to 15 years. So the 3 pillars are our bodies, our thoughts, and our behaviors. Mm. So they identified those. And they looked at these fundamental pillars, and they've managed to pull out seven things that they think will change over the next 10 to 15 years. And reading through them, there's some really interesting stuff. So the first thing that they say is our bodies will be augmented. Mm-hmm. And they talk about how humans will be smarter, stronger, and more capable than today. Things like contact lenses that can take pictures or videos, universal language translator earbuds that allow us to communicate anywhere in the world, exosuits that increase physical strength, stuff like Majida's really interested in, implants in the brain, mm-hmm. Microchips and neural laser to mind networks, and you know, subdermal RFID chips that allow us to unlock doors or computer passwords with just a wave of a hand. All of these things we've spoken about.
Yeah.
You know, these don't seem too far away. They then move on to this thing where our thought processes will be faster and more transferable. So we talk about wearable and implantable brain-machine interfaces, what they're calling BMIs.
Mm.
Elon Musk's Neuralink is one of the bigger examples of that. And what they talk about is how now when we go on a holiday or when we're on a vacation or something like that, we upload photos and we upload, you know, videos and people can look at that. But what if you could share the actual experience with people? You know, if you could, like, transmit the images and the feelings and the smells and all of that via, you know, these BMIs, and that's what they're looking at next. They're talking about gamification and behavioral science and how it will increase human productivity. Early innovators of this were actually Uber. They harnessed behavioral science, gamification, and AI, the whole thing about watching the taxi as it comes towards you, gamifying the idea that they are saying that a whole bunch of the stuff that we look at in the future and the way in which we interact with one another will be a lot more gamified.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting stuff. They're saying we will be more empathetic. So the adoption of virtual reality can play an influential role in our ability to understand perspectives other than our own. So we talk about the plights of refugees. We talk about the floods up in Kelantan or wherever it is. You know, but it's not only we can't really see and feel what that's like. What about if you had an AI app or you had AI and you could actually see what it's like to be a refugee in a part of a certain part of the world? You know, would that make you donate more to charity if you could actually physically see it through somebody else's eyes? That's what they're talking about. The emergence of extreme personalization and customization. For example, in addition to location and past purchase history data, marketers may be able to use emotional filters based on our activity to change the tone of their message on the spot in response to our current mood. We spoke about that a couple of weeks ago about the investment banking company who were taking language. They were listening in and they were converting it into text, and the machines were then responding to us.
Mm-hmm.
All getting a little bit scary. None of this stuff, as we say, seems too far-fetched as of yet. But they're talking about how business practices will shift. Our conversations focused on societal values will gain a great deal of attention. So what do we value most? Is it intelligence, self-fulfillment, success, happiness, quality of life, all of this stuff? If one country decided they wanted to create a nation of super intelligent and physically augmented humans, what would the rest of the world do? Would they then decide, okay, we need to catch up, we need to do that, and maybe our citizens should be something like that? I mean, this whole idea was more of a kind of thought process and, you know, and something to kind of ruminate on over the next few days. But it really, and I've said this before on the show, it feels like all of these things that we were talking about 2-3 years ago that seemed so far-fetched are now really coming to fruition very, very quickly, right? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, they said that this is how the world will be like in 2030. This is in the next 10
years.
15
years.
This will be within our lifetime that all of this will happen. We will be around to see all this, to see brain implants, to see how the world will be more AI-centric or AR-centric.
I mean, we have a colleague walking around the office right now who has a chip on his arm that automatically detects his sugar levels, you know, and when it gets to a certain point, it alerts him. It then feeds data to an app, which then alerts his doctor and keeps them all on track.
Yeah.
This is happening already.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people, I think I have a few friends who have gone through this already, where they have wearable tech that sends data to the doctors and stuff, because it enables them to monitor them on a 24-hour, 24/7 basis.
Mm.
The thing that I'm most most interested about is the one where they say that people will have more empathy in the future, because that one is very, very, very true.
Right.
Because we kind of live in bubbles now. We have, like, you know, if you're comfortable in a certain kind of bubble, then you don't know how to relate to someone else who's outside that bubble. If we go back, like, everyone goes back to the U.S. elections of last year. But if people were able to see what it was like in the red states and how the rural U.S. operates and stuff, then last year wouldn't have happened.
Right.
For better or worse, it wouldn't have happened. So, you know, things like that, because there was an experiment that they did last year. I forgot who, but someone was putting on a play to do with refugees.
I remember.
Right? Yes. So they came to the office and then they got some of us to sort of participate in like their marketing thing. And what they did was they didn't tell us what it was. They asked us to fill up a form with a few personal details about ourselves. And then they took us into the room, like the meeting room. They cleared it out. They blindfolded us. And then after that, they proceeded to like mark your arms and stuff. If you had scars. And I have like a scar from surgery on one of my arms, so they marked it, and then they proceed to ask you like very personal questions in like a very dominating way. And just that 5 or 10 minutes alone gives you perspective into what it is like to be a refugee in another country, and it sort of like shifted my perspective on like, oh, okay, so this is, I wouldn't have ever given it that much thought, but then it sort of, it makes you understand on a level that just reading a book or an article or seeing like videos doesn't give you. So putting someone in a VR experience, like what you're saying, like in like an underwater thing and all, it gives you that perspective of what it's like to be in someone else's country or someone else's shoes or in a disaster zone. So that part, I think I like the best. The other things will just follow, like tech and you know, wearable tech and stuff. It'll just, if it's convenient, people will pick up on it. But the empathy thing, I think, is like super important.
I think that was a play by Terry Andekas and Tanaga Nita.
It was, yes.
Skin, right. Yeah. Skin. Yeah. That was it.
Really interesting, because I actually went to that play itself, and the immersion into it is really, really interesting. And now that we're talking about things like AR and VR, if I could put on a headset and then be transported to another place, I don't have to be there physically, but then VR has come so far that it's so real. And now we are talking about adding things like smells and sounds and other textures to it, that it will be almost exactly like being in that place itself. We've seen not only how it makes us more empathetic of conditions of other people, but how we're already using it for things like architecture and design and things like that. That before you build something, you can already see whether or not it will affect the communities around you and the people around you, how they will flow to it. You become more aware of the things around you before you even build a bridge or a building or something like that.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, everything that you see, like even they said, there's one where you said that you can, the Neuralink thing, where you download all your thoughts and your emotions into like something, and then you can transfer it into somebody else so they can feel it. I know it sounds scary, because you're going like, oh, won't people travel anymore and won't they go places? I think people will still go places. It's going to be, it's not going to be like being there physically. But every physical reaction that you have or response that you have is processed by the brain. So if you can give someone that experience, let's say someone who's bedridden or someone who's sick, someone who can't go there.
Exactly.
You are giving them maybe 95% of the experience if they have like a VR headset. Because, I mean, everything that you experience in your body goes through the brain first, right? So if you can download that into someone else's brain, then they are basically feeling everything that you felt on your trip.
It's a wonderful idea. It's a wonderful idea. Okay, we've got to take a break. Some more music coming up from Haim. Don't Save Me. That's coming up next. When we come back, final story of the day, how South Korea is building a $35 billion US dollar city designed to eliminate the need for cars. That's interesting. Right, we'll be right back in just a couple of minutes. BFM 89.9.
Bureaucratic failures multiply. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Enterprise BizBytes. Final story of the day, how South Korea is building a $35 billion city designed to eliminate the need for cars. How does this work, then? What are they doing?
No, I didn't even know that this was an actual thing. It's been going on since 2000, so it's like 17 years old. Yeah, it's in the International Business District in Songdo. Is that how you say it? Songdo, South Korea.
I don't know.
Yeah, so
let's pretend it is.
Yeah, let's pretend it is. And so it's a plan that they started in 2000, so almost 18 years now. It's a $35 billion district, and it's currently a work in progress. It's about the size of downtown Boston, and it was designed to eliminate the need for cars. That's like its number one goal.
Mm.
It began, the planning started in 2000, then they started building it in 2002. The area prioritizes mass transit like buses, subways, and bikes instead of road traffic. And then they say when it's completed in 2020, the district will span 100 million square feet.
Wow.
Yeah, so they're planning big. But the biggest reason for this is they want it to be eco-friendly, and they want it to they want its people to not depend on cars and the pollution that comes out from cars at all. So from the first planning stages, the developers aim to make the district eco-friendly by using features with a mixed-use urban plan, meaning that its retail, office space, parks, medical facilities, and schools are all close to housing. Apartment buildings and businesses were built 12 minutes within bus or subway stops. 15 miles of bike lanes go through the district, connecting a larger 90-mile network in the Songdo city. 40% of the area is reserved for green space, which is double the amount that is reserved for New York. That means they also encourage people to walk.
Mm.
And then the IBD's largest park, which measures about 101 acres, was inspired by Manhattan Central Park. So the biggest thing and the most interesting thing for me is that there are no trash trucks. So instead of using trucks and lorries to go pick up their rubbish, they use a pneumatic tube system that sucks the trash from chutes in the residential buildings to a central sorting facility in about a matter of seconds.
That's wow. A great idea.
Yeah. And then the stuff is either turned into energy or it's recycled completely. So they want to be zero waste as well.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So you just drop your trash down a chute, it's
yep.
gone.
Yeah. So just imagine like an apartment complex. There's like a main trash system. So you just drop it in and then the chute carries it from there all the way to wherever it is in the city. I guess underground. They don't say whether it's a subway system, but I guess it's underground.
I'm imagining so, yeah.
Yeah. Songdo City produces a third fewer greenhouse gases compared to any other city of the same size. And they're also planning to go bigger in the coming years. They say in the next 3 years at least. It's part of a larger development plan called the Incheon Free Economic Zone in Songdo City, which is spearheaded by the South Korean government. 20,000 units are complete or under construction in the IBD. About 50,000 people already live there, and approximately 100,000 residents live in the greater Songdo city area.
So this is showing then, you know, with proper planning, prevents poor performance.
Poor performance prevents pollution.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Sitting down, it's a great idea. Sitting down with actual architects and green dreamers or whatever we want to call them. Right, we want to build a green city. What do we... That trash idea is a superb idea and really simple.
But this is something that you can put in, but when you are building a new development, because you're going to have to dig everything out and put the chutes in. And it's great because it's something new. But for existing residentials, it's going to be a nightmare to start installing for the rest of the city.
Yeah, I mean, for existing, maybe you don't have to do the chute system, but even if people planned on, you know, having cleaner trucks, I mean, that would be a big thing. I guess the biggest problem is that residents complain that it's not close enough to Seoul because they want to travel in and out and it's not close to the business districts of Korea. But other than that, it's you know, it seems to be going pretty well.
I love the idea of this.
Mm. Yeah.
Right, we have to wrap up. We've come to the end of today's show. We will be back, of course, tomorrow. Same time, same place at noon. Quickly running through the stories that we covered, though, today. We started off with how a guy is suggesting that maybe we could start unlocking our phone using sweat or other bodily fluids.
Let's hope it's just sweat.
And then we spoke about a biodegradable car created by the students from Eindhoven University using natural fibers, flax, and sugar beets.
Yeah, so it's a sweet ride.
Oh dear.
We moved into how Safe Catch wants to make mercury safe tuna. So they want to clean up the oceans and prevent people from mercury poisoning.
He's making his giggle here on air. We then moved on to a story about transhumanism, the future of humanity, 7 ways the world will change by 2030, by the Forbes Visionary Innovation Group. That's one of the stories we did.
Yeah, and then we finished off with a South Korean city in the IBD in Songdo City that plans to have no cars in the the future.
That's it. Don't go anywhere, though, because coming up after the 1 o'clock news, it is the Breakfast Grill replay. Now, since 1985, Emirates has grown from a two-plane operation to one of the world's biggest long-haul airlines. After years of tremendous growth, its last fiscal year saw a drastic decline of about 70% in net income. Its first decline in 5 years. The Breakfast Grill spoke to Emirates country manager for Singapore, Malaysia and Brunei. It was Andrew Bunn to discuss what's next for the Gulf carrier and how this region contributes to the airline's growth plans. I'm Rich Bradbury on behalf of Arvind Nuvaraj and Majida Hashim. It has been Enterprise BizBytes on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.